Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, you've brought us a really fascinating, kind of complex set of materials. It looks like we're weaving together things like military history, media analysis, even conspiracy theories.
That's right.
All seen through this lens of layered communication.
Exactly. And our mission today, tailored for you listening, is to explore how these layers get built. We're diving deep into the work of Marie Lynn and her framework for decoding complexity, trying to find those, you know, hidden truths inside what often just sounds like noise.
Or even nonsense sometimes.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Marie Lynn doesn't just focus on what's said, but the how, the structure. She talks about this perennial joke, a communication designed to last, to persist.
Okay.
So our goal isn't just to get the punchline. We want to dissect the craft behind it.
Yeah.
And the core concept, the engine for this whole thing, is double entendre.
Double entendre, like the literary device.
Similar, but more operational. In this context, it's a phrase, a story, maybe even an image, intentionally built with two meanings. One is negative, obvious, easy to grab onto, especially if you're already feeling negative.
Right.
And the other is positive. It contains the real actionable truth, but you have to be willing to look past the surface negativity.
And Marie Lynn uses a specific, pretty wild example to demonstrate this system, doesn't she?
She does. The perfect case study, apparently. Right. The Archon's conspiracy theory. It's everywhere online. Very high contrast, very dramatic.
The one about interdimensional beings.
That's the one. We're going to take that theory, which seems totally out there, and use it like a key. The idea is to unlock some aha moments about how media works, showing that these narratives aren't random. They're engineered professionally.
Okay, I'm intrigued. Moving beyond coincidence. I like that. Let's dive in.
All right. So to ground this idea of inverted reality, Marie Lynn points to something specific, something recent, a kind of public marker. She describes a group, maybe 10 people, gathered right in front of the White House. And the key detail she notes is that they're all strikingly, almost universally beautiful. Just aesthetically very appealing people.
Interesting detail. What were they doing?
They were filming a video, a short message, very simple. This division, it needs to end.
Huh. That sounds pretty generic, actually, like a PSA. You hear calls for unity all the time. How does she link that 10 beautiful people asking for unity to the Archons? It seems like a huge jump.
It does, on the surface. But she connects the message to the theory. The theory, the one circulating online, posits that Archons are these interdimensional beings that harvest negativity.
Right, the negativity feeders.
Exactly. So Marie Lynn argues this theory is the perfect good joke to unpack because it's so compelling, so sticky, and it has all the elements of this double entendre system baked in. The beautiful people, by saying this division needs to end, are implicitly talking about cutting off the food supply for these theoretical Archons. They want to end the negativity the Archons supposedly feed on.
Okay, I see the link now. They're not just asking for general unity. They're targeting the fuel source described in the conspiracy. But who are these beautiful people then, logistically? Are they actors? Influencers?
This is where it gets into military history.
Mm-hmm.
Marie Lynn identifies them as being connected to the Ghost Army.
The World War II Deception Unit. The 23rd Headquarters Special Troops.
The very same. Known for inflatable tanks, sound effects, fake radio traffic. Masters of deception. Marie Lynn's analysis suggests this unit, or its function, still exists.
Wow.
And operates under a new motto. One that's like the complete opposite of traditional military thinking. They use the phrase Newman Rowe Doctrine.
The Newman Rowe Doctrine. The original was about, you know, keeping foreign powers out of the Americas, often pretty aggressively. What's the new version?
The motto attached to it, according to the source, is let's make love.
Okay, wait. Let's make love. As a military doctrine, that's a massive shift. What does that mean in practice? How does that connect to the beautiful people at the White House?
It signifies a total inversion of conflict resolution.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of force and exclusion, the method is inclusion and attraction. The analysis suggests these beautiful individuals are involved in what Marie Lynn calls babysitting.
Babysitting. Who are they babysitting?
Very awful people. The idea, dark as it sounds, is logistically, well, interesting, truly dangerous, negative individuals.
Mm.
The real 3D monsters are often drawn to beauty.
Huh.
Maybe they envy it. Maybe they want to control it, possess it.
Okay.
So these Ghost Army members, noted for their looks and also their apparent mental stability, she contrasts them with typical protesters who might seem unwell. They position themselves near these negative targets, their job, keep them contained, distracted, documented.
Documented.
Yes. Until they can be, quote, delivered to law enforcement. They're essentially human bait.
Human bait. But with a positive mission, you're saying. Containment, not entrapment.
That seems to be the interpretation. Containment through attraction. Mm-hmm. It completely flips the script on what we think of as activism or even intelligence work.
It does. That's a huge so what for anyone listening. But, okay, if these beautiful people are the babysitters playing this subtle containment role, what about the people who aren't subtle? The loud ones? The celebrities, the figures constantly in the news, generating conflict.
Yes. That brings us to the other side of the coin.
Yeah.
The cost. Marie Lynn draws a sharp, almost tragic contrast between these babysitters, who seem relatively unharmed by their work, and the managers, or generals.
Managers, generals.
These are the high-profile figures who have to execute the front-facing strategy, the ones who need to be loud, often negative, to attract the really big monsters. And she names names.
Ooh.
Figures like Rosie O'Donnell, Ellen DeGeneres, Robert De Niro, George Clooney. According to this analysis, their job requires them to spew hate the loudest, to amplify division. Why? Because that's what draws out the most aggressive, destructive elements in society. It's like flypaper for monsters.
Okay, I have to push back here a little. That's a massive claim that celebrities known for, say, political activism or strong opinions are actually performing a role to attract negative forces. That runs counter to, well, pretty much everything the public assumes.
It absolutely does. It's a total inversion.
And you mentioned Marie Lynn says they look unwell because of this. How does she connect their public performance to their physical health? What's the mechanism?
The mechanism is disingenuousness. Constant, high-stakes disingenuousness. The idea is that these managers are forced to act against their own core values, publicly, relentlessly.
Probably so.
They have to promote narratives they might not believe, amplify conflict, maybe even embody negativity, all to effectively manage this target demographic of monsters. And doing that, performing this intense, insincere role constantly, Marie Lynn says it's, quote, extremely derelict to their health and their appearance.
Derelict. Strong word.
It implies damage. It's not just the stress of fame. It's described as a kind of moral injury, a psychological poisoning that manifests physically. The source suggests they might be fundamentally good, beautiful people inside who've taken on an incredibly toxic job. They get injured in the course of their work, managing the world's negativity, and you can supposedly see that damage.
So the takeaway Marie Lynn offers is, when you see photos of these powerful figures looking haggard, worn out, maybe unhealthy, we shouldn't see it as proof they're evil or just aging badly.
Exactly. Instead of dunking on them online, the suggestion is to see it as a potential professional hazard, a sign that the toxic role they're playing, this inverted public service, is taking its toll. It's like a visible marker that the venom they're attracting is actually hurting them.
It flips the whole narrative of celebrity misery or perceived villainy on its head. If true, their visible decline would be evidence the system is working in a strange way.
That's the challenging implication, yes. Confirmation through degradation.
Okay, so we have this inverted reality, these different roles. Let's get back to the operating system behind it all, the double entendre. You mentioned it's deployed by a clown. We need to define that term properly later.
We will.
But this system ensures that major narratives carry two meanings at once. Can you break down how that works, the two paths?
Right. The double entendre system essentially creates a fork in the road for anyone receiving the information. It acts like a filter. Path one is the negative path.
And who goes down that path?
This path is specifically designed, Marie Lynn argues, to attract and trap people who are already maybe miserable or perhaps intellectually lazy. People looking for easy answers, grand explanations for why things are bad.
The conspiracy rabbit hole.
Pretty much. They tend to operate on this flawed idea. If it's negative, if it's scary, if it confirms my worst fears about the world, then it must be true. So when they encounter the Archon story, interdimensional beings feeding on negativity, they latch onto it. It confirms their bias.
And this leads them
into an endless loop, chasing shadows, debating unprovable theories. Marie Lynn is very direct here. She calls this negative interpretation an idiot trap, designed to occupy and, frankly, neutralize people who can't or won't engage with nuance.
Harsh, but okay, that's the trap. But double entendre implies two meanings. What's the alternative? The positive path.
The positive path is for the people who know better. That's the phrase used. These are individuals who recognize the negative story is likely a construct, a distraction.
So they look deeper.
They look for the underlying mechanics, the logistics, the constructive truth. This path holds the real, hidden information about how things actually operate and maybe how to navigate reality more effectively. Marie Lynn insists, if you want to understand the system, you have to actively seek the positive side of the joke every single time. Don't get stuck in the negative.
That makes logical sense as a principle. But what happens psychologically if someone gets really stuck on that negative path, believing everyone's controlled by archons, for instance? Where does that kind of thinking lead?
It can lead to a dangerous place. Marie-Lynn identifies a subgroup that develops this kind of, well, she calls it a psychosis, driven by a sense of moral superiority. They start thinking everybody else is evil or controlled or stupid.
Except me.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And the logical conclusion of that thought process, if everyone else is tainted, you have to withdraw. It leads to self-imposed solitary confinement. They cut themselves off, convinced they're the last sane person.
That sounds incredibly isolating and just damaging.
It does.
Yeah.
But here comes the inversion again, the aha moment for this section. Marie-Lynn argues that this self-imposed isolation, paradoxically, can actually be a good tool in order to awaken.
How can cutting yourself off be good?
Because theoretically, they've succeeded in one thing, removing the external negative inputs. They've shut out the media they hate, the society they despise. So what's left?
Just themselves and their thoughts.
And hopefully, the internet connection feeding them the negativity. If they could be prompted to turn that off, too, and actually just sit and contemplate their own life, their own choices, the isolation stops being a prison and becomes a potential space for reflection, a catalyst.
So the negative path is so negative, it's designed to push people into isolation, hoping they'll hit bottom and then, what, snap out of it.
That's the phrase used, yes.
Yeah.
Snap out of it. It's a radical, almost counterintuitive strategy for prompting self-reflection.
This whole approach seems to shift focus away from like magic or complex psychology towards something much more grounded, practical methods.
Exactly. And that connects directly to Marie-Lynn's strong preference for logistics over occult or purely psychological explanations.
Tell me more about that. Why logistics?
She's quite critical of interpretations that overcredit magic or abstract ideas as the main drivers of world events. She really pushes you, the learner, to focus on the logistics, the measurable, practical, step-by-step processes, how things are actually built, run, managed. She sees that as being much closer to the direct truth.
Can you give a concrete example of this focus on logistics?
Yeah, the best one is her emphasis on timestamps.
Timestamps, like on a file or a post.
Exactly. She considers them incredibly important, maybe the most important thing in the world, in her words. She traces this back, historically, IBM creating the clock-in, clock-out system. Timestamping is fundamental to corporate accountability, to tracking reality.
Okay.
So her point is, when people repost content online, screenshots, articles, whatever, and they deliberately remove the timestamp, they're actively obscuring reality. They're removing a crucial piece of logistical data.
Because you lose context.
Precisely. You lose the when. And if you don't know when something happened or was created, you can't place it accurately within the sequence of events. You can't analyze the operation logically. Removing the timestamp hinders the logistical analysis. It muddies the water.
Okay, we've talked about the effect of the double entendre, the paths and the mechanism logistics over magic. Now let's trace it back. The Archon story itself. Where did Marie-Lynn say it actually came from, if it's not ancient Gnosticism bubbling up?
Right. She's very clear on this. It's not presented as some organic mythological revival. She identifies it as a fabricated conspiracy theory.
Yeah.
Engineered.
Engineered by whom?
By military intelligence. Specifically, she traces its origins to the U.S. Army Signal Corps.
The Signal Corps. Again, they handle communications, training, indoctrination. Why would they be involved in creating a basically spiritual conspiracy theory? That seems outside their usual remit.
Because narrative construction is part of communication, training, and potentially psychological operations. Marie-Lynn points out that the Signal Corps has historically been based in New York, a center for media and communication. They specialize in building stories.
Okay, so they build stories, but why this kind of story? What's the purpose of these official edge stories, as she calls them?
They have specific design parameters. They need to be compelling, addictive, get people talking. But critically, they must be unprovable.
Unprovable. Why is that important?
Think about it. If the story involved, say, specific named individuals or provable actions, the actual targets, the real-world negative actors, could potentially sue for libel or take concrete steps to debunk it and shut it down.
Okay.
But if the story is about interdimensional beings, it's impossible to prove or disprove definitively. It lacks the tangible evidence needed for serious investigators to gain traction, but it has that unprovable mystique that allows it to captivate people who aren't too bright for the longest time possible. Just hangs around, endlessly debatable.
So it's a safe way to circulate a certain idea without triggering a direct, effective counterattack from the people it's implicitly criticizing.
But what's the educational goal then, if it just traps people on the negative path? The function is described as subtle education without provoking organized backlash. It's a way to educate the public that, quote, immense a-holes are monsters.
Right.
In a way that the real monsters, the ones being targeted, just dismiss the whole thing. If you tell a powerful, corrupt person they're controlled by interdimensional archons, what are they going to do?
Laugh. Assume you're crazy.
Exactly. They feel safe because the accusation is absurd on its face. They aren't literally interdimensional. So the core message, these people are monstrous, gets to circulate, while the actual monsters feel immune because the form of the accusation is fantastical. It's a clever deflection.
Which brings us back to the clown. We need that definition now. It's clearly not about red noses and floppy shoes here.
Definitely not. Marie Lynn defines the clown as a highly skilled professional of the circus. Emphasis on professional and circus, meaning experts in staging, performance, illusion. These individuals are supposedly capable of communicating on 5 layers simultaneously.
5 layers?
Yes, using the double entendre system as their primary tool. The goal, deliver the complete, positive logistical truth directly to those smart enough or trained enough to see it.
Okay.
While simultaneously deploying the negative, fabricated story like the Archons to mislead and occupy those she terms stupid people. The clown is the architect and operator of this whole layered communication system.
So let's dismiss the interdimensional Archons as the fabricated layer. Who are the real Archons then? The ones the story is indirectly pointing at. The 3D Archons.
The real ones are the logistical controllers of negativity. Marie Lynn calls them the immense a-holes who control the misery industrial complex.
The misery industrial complex. That's a chilling phrase.
It is. And she gives them a specific label, an actionable name. The Schadenfreudians.
Schadenfreudians. Based on Schadenfreude, the pleasure in others' misfortune.
Precisely. These are the people, the 3D human actors, who allegedly run systems that profit from or fuel the public distress. They benefit from emotional turmoil, intellectual confusion, social division. They design or manipulate systems, political, economic, media, to generate misery, because that's where their power, influence, or maybe just their satisfaction comes from. They are the human manufacturers and exploiters of the negative side of the double entendre.
This analysis also touches on how even negative reactions from the public can be turned into something useful for the system, the concept of useless haters.
Yes, that's Marie Lynn's term. An update on the older, darker phrase, useless eaters. In this context, useless haters refers to people so consumed by negativity, often directed at specific public figures, that they inadvertently become useful.
Useful? How can being a hater be useful to the person you hate?
She uses Donald Trump as an example, calling him the greatest supervillain in this operational sense. The idea is that figures like him can masterfully harness the energy of their detractors.
Oh.
By creating such intense polarization, think of Trump derangement syndrome, for instance. The haters dedicate enormous amounts of energy to repeating the negative narrative, sharing the outrage, amplifying the drama. They become a free distribution network.
Ah, so they spread the message further.
Exactly. They ensure the story reaches the places where the sun don't shine, getting it out to demographics who might not otherwise pay attention. They make the drama feel intensely real to other people who are susceptible to that kind of narrative. This is why, Marie Lynn notes, Trump actually thanked his haters publicly. They were doing essential logistical work for him, spreading the story, keeping the drama alive, all for free. They made themselves super duper useful.
Wow. Okay, that leads us into how culture itself and even language can be part of this system. Marie Lynn identifies the French language specifically as a tool for psychological warfare. Why French? What's special about it?
It's about how French is perceived, particularly by Americans. They have a built-in double entendre in the cultural mind. On one level, it's a foreign language, complex, with nuances that require real effort to decode. So it functions as an effective encryption system.
Okay, it's hard for outsiders to understand deeply.
Right. But on another level, American culture often views French things, the language, the fashion, the films, as inherently glamorous and sexy.
Right.
Sophisticated.
True, there's that stereotype.
And that perception lowers cognitive defenses. People might engage with French content, seeking that glamour or sophistication, but they're potentially unaware they're also consuming encrypted political or social commentary, maybe even disclosures.
And this layering appears even in things like corporate names.
Yes. She gives a striking example. Sinclair Broadcasting Group, huge media conglomerate in the U.S.
Right.
Break down the name phonetically.
Right.
Sinclair. What does that sound like?
Sin in the clear.
Sin in the clear. While the public sees a news brand, Marie Lynn argues the name itself is an encoded disclosure of its function. It's a label telling you what it does. She suggests figures associated with such outlets, she mentions Jimmy Kimmel as an example in the broader media landscape, are tasked with misinforming, miseducating, and misrepresenting everything in the clear. The surface content is the news, the negative path, often, but the name itself hints at the positive truth, a warning about its potential function.
So if the language itself can be used this way, what about French culture, like movies?
Marie Lynn argues that French movies, particularly those from Quebec, often function as disclosures about what's going to happen to the Americans, or as predictions about ongoing social decay, all packaged as high art.
Predictions or warnings hidden in plain sight as entertainment.
Exactly. And she zeroes in on one filmmaker in particular, Denise Arcand.
Denise Arcand, the Canadian director.
Yes. And she notes the name's phonetics in French. Denis Arcand, or Aaron.
Aaron sounds a bit like Arcand.
That's the suggested link, a deliberate phonetic resonance. She sees Arcand's work, especially his 1986 film The Decline of the American Empire, as a prime example of categorical disclosure.
The Decline of the American Empire. What's the specific warning embedded in that film, according to this analysis?
Marie Lynn argues the film itself, even just its poster, serves as a warning. The story depicts intellectuals whose lives, relationships, and even intellectual pursuits are falling apart. Why? Because they're fundamentally dedicated to their app. Well, the term uses P.
Okay. But she expands that term beyond just sex, right? It's used metaphorically.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's broadened to mean any captivating, ultimately non-productive, distracting application or obsession that consumes your attention and prevents you from doing real, creative, constructive work.
Like what?
She gives a very personal, relatable example.
Yeah.
Her own past fixation with Pinterest.
Pinterest.
Yeah. She describes spending hours scrolling, looking at what other people were making, decorating, crafting, worrying about it, comparing, but not actually doing any crafting herself. It was paralyzing. That obsessive, distracting focus was her personal P in this context. Arcand's film, she argues, was disclosing the devastating societal impact when a whole culture gets hooked on similar, ultimately empty distractions.
That's a really interesting way to interpret it, the medium or the process being the message more than the specific content. And Marie Lynn claims these disclosures are so embedded, they even reference personal logistical details of people involved in the system.
Yes, this is where the analysis gets incredibly specific, using her own family history as anecdotal proof of concept. She claims Robert De Niro, one of the generals previously mentioned,
right, tasked with negativity,
has actually woven details about her grandparents' logistical work into two of his major films, essentially mocking or referencing their roles.
Okay, that's a bold claim. What are the examples?
First, the comedy Meet the Parents. De Niro plays Jack Burns, the father-in-law who's ex-CIA, vetting Ben Stiller's character, knows everything because he's listening in, has surveillance everywhere.
The circle of trust.
Right. Marie Lynn says this is a comedic riff on her maternal grandparents, who she refers to as the parents involved in managing the system. Then, completely different genre, Terry Gilliam's Brazil.
Dystopian masterpiece. De Niro plays Tuttle, the renegade heating engineer.
Exactly. The guy fighting the bureaucratic system, obsessed with fixing the malfunctioning HVAC. Marie Lynn states this is a direct reference to her paternal grandfather.
And his job was...
He was the head HVAC engineer for the largest hospital in Canada at the time.
And what was significant about that hospital?
She describes it as this enormous, complex institution housing 5,000 people. A real-world logistical labyrinth of heating, cooling, ventilation, containment. She even calls it a real-world exemplification of Arkham Asylum.
So the point of sharing this isn't just family history.
No, not at all. It's to illustrate the operating principle of the clown. Highly specific logistical truths about the system and the people running it are hidden in plain sight, embedded within popular culture, often disguised as comedy or fantasy, making them easily dismissible. The truth is there, but layered.
Okay, so this principle of inversion is key. We've heard it throughout the New Monroe Doctrine, the function of celebrity negativity, the meaning of isolation. Marie Lynn's core assertion is that we live in a 100% inverted culture, right? Where truth is often the opposite of the surface appearance.
That's the foundational assumption. And it's crucial for the final step in decoding the Arcand's joke.
Which involves another layer of encryption.
Yes, a specific type of French slang, verlan.
Verlan. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. Verlan is a sublanguage, mostly associated with urban youth culture in France, especially Paris. It works by inverting or flipping the syllables of words. usually two-syllable words. The name Verlan itself is an example. It's the inversion of l'envers, which means the inverse or backwards.
So it's like pig Latin, but with syllable flipping.
Sort of, but more integrated into spoken French slang. It creates a code that's pretty opaque to outsiders. It's encryption built on top of the existing French language encryption we talked about earlier.
Can you give a quick example so we get the mechanics?
Okay, a classic one is the word femme, woman. In Verlan, it becomes meuf, or flic, cop, derogatory, becomes couf. You flip the syllables phonetically. Sometimes the meaning shifts, too. A reversed word might take on a cool connotation, like méchant becomes chamé, which can mean awesome or wicked.
Okay, syllable flipping. Got it. Now, apply this logic, this Verlan version, to the big word we've been dissecting all this time, archon. This is the big reveal, isn't it?
This is the punchline of the perennial joke, according to Marie Lynn. If you take archon and apply that Verlan-style syllabic inversion, phonetically, what do you get? Archon flips to.
Chant, ar, connard.
Connards, exactly.
And connards. What does that mean in French slang?
Connard or canard is derived from, it's pretty crude slang. It means dumbass, idiot, jerk.
Wow.
And there's another phonetic echo she points out. Archon also sounds quite similar to the French word canard.
Canard, which means?
Duck. But colloquially, it also means a hoax or a false story.
So the name itself, when decoded through French slang and inversion, labels the believer as a dumbass and the story as a hoax.
That's the interpretation. The layering is complete. The joke lands.
The theory itself contains its own refutation, encoded in the name.
Precisely. The whole narrative, interdimensional beings, negativity harvesting, is presented as a negative, compelling, but ultimately unprovable story. It's meticulously crafted by the clowns. And if you fall for the negative, literal interpretation, the hidden Verlan, meaning embedded in the name Archon, reveals that you, the believer, are the actual target of the joke, a conar. It confirms the negative story was fabricated specifically to filter and label those who are drawn to it.
So what does this imply for all the people online right now sharing Archon theories, thinking they're revealing some ultimate hidden truth?
The conclusion Marie Lynn draws from this is pretty stark. She suggests that people who obsessively repeat these kinds of sensational, negative, fabricated narratives are essentially unknowingly acting as the free workforce of the ghost army.
The free workforce? How?
They're doing the system's work by distributing the official negative edge story. They amplify the hoax. In her terms, they volunteered for service. They become MKUltra volunteers.
MKUltra volunteers, that sounds ominous. Used for what?
Used as a kind of barometer. Their engagement with and amplification of the official hoax helps intelligence systems, presumably, to measure the level of Dami stupidity or gullibility in the general public. End quote. Their belief in the hoax becomes data about the public's susceptibility.
That implies the path to real insight isn't digging deeper into the scary stuff.
Exactly. It's looking elsewhere. Marie Lynn contrasts this with her own experience, which she humorously calls her MK Ultra training, which she says simply involved watching delightful American pop culture when she was growing up.
Pop culture is training.
Yes, because that pop culture, she argues, was also engineered, but often with a positive goal, to instill the American dream, perhaps, or functional societal values. The key takeaway is that the deeper layers of useful information aren't hidden in the repulsive, traumatic, hateful things the managers are forced to spew. The real clues, the structural truths, are supposedly embedded in everything you loved growing up.
The delightful things, the music, the movies, the shows.
Yes, because those were also carefully fabricated, likely by skilled clowns, but with a positive or constructive goal in mind. They contain the embedded truth, but accessed through enjoyment, not fear. Hashtag tag outro.
Wow. Okay, what a journey that was. We started with 10 beautiful people filming a message at the White House.
Right.
We explored why major celebrities might look unwell as a kind of professional hazard.
Yeah.
Identified the Signal Corps as a potential source for the Archon's narrative itself. Dug into French language and Denis Archon films as psychological warfare and disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
And landed on this idea that the Archon's theory, through Verlan, decodes to conners, essentially labeling believers as dumbasses for buying the negative hoax.
It brings us right back to that fundamental choice, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The choice symbolized perhaps by the Apple logo, the bitten apple of knowledge of good and evil, maybe on the phone or computer you're using right now.
How so?
You, the listener, get to choose. You can pursue only the knowledge of evil, get lost in the Archon, sorry, the endless negative news cycle, the repulsive drama. That's one path. Or you can engage with the positive side of the double entendre. Focus on the logistics, the actual mechanics, the constructive purpose behind the facade. Look for the good people, the clowns, the ghost army, who might be, in their own very strange way, making love to humanity by managing its darkest elements.
And Marie Lynn offers a very specific strategy for finding that positive path, doesn't she? A practical takeaway.
She does, a liberating one, potentially. She says the easiest way to access the deeper, positive truth about how reality is structured is simply to focus on everything you loved growing up.
The things that brought you joy.
Exactly. Your favorite movies, music, books from your formative years. She claims those delightful things contain 4 more layers of information than the negative stuff. They offer a sense of completion, understanding, even accomplishment, which is totally missing from the endless trauma loop of fear-based media.
So that leaves us with a final thought, something for you, the listener, to mull over.
If we take Marie Lynn's definition of love, doing something that helps people, even monsters, reveal and be themselves, potentially for containment or understanding, what does that really imply about the deeper intentions of the clowns who craft these incredibly elaborate, dramatic, duality-driven narratives?
If the entire culture of hate and fear is, on some level, a meticulously constructed hoax designed to filter people, what constructive truth might your own most beloved piece of pop culture be trying to reveal to you? Maybe go back, rewatch that favorite movie, listen to that album you loved, and ask yourself, beyond the surface enjoyment, what logistical structure, what positive message, what hidden truth was being embedded there for you to find?